A pleasure and an honor to introduce Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute. I speak as one of many scientists who have come from overseas to work here, tempted by the idea of a new and quite different kind of institute, lured by the promise of a quiet and peaceful place to work, undisturbed and without distractions. Perimeter Institute is certainly unusual. And one of the most unusual things about it is, in fact, its executive director. To mastermind an operation like this requires, of course, a breadth of skills and knowledge rarely found in a single person. Not surprisingly, that breadth is reflected in Howard's curriculum vitae. Howard grew up in Toronto, where he obtained a bachelor's in physics and philosophy. An interest in philosophy is a common trait among scientists interested in fundamental questions. And after his bachelor's, Howard went on to complete a master's in philosophy at the University of Toronto. Having apparently sated his philosophical thirst, he then did a master's in theoretical physics at Imperial College in London, England. Ever restless, it would seem, he then spent several years in Holland, teaching, studying, and working for Elsevier, a well-known scientific publishing company. As fate would have it, Howard was then drawn back to Canada, where he completed a PhD in theoretical physics at the University of Waterloo. He had the good taste to choose as a topic for his PhD thesis Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is widely regarded as the most beautiful theory yet devised. As the great Russian physicist Landau once said, interest in the general theory of relativity is the unmistakable hallmark of the born theoretical physicist. Despite Landau's assertion, however, after obtaining his PhD, Howard was tempted by Wall Street. But again, the hand of fate intervened to keep him in Waterloo, this time at the instigation of Mike Lazaridis. And Howard was appointed executive director of the newly founded Perimeter Institute. Surveying Howard's protean CV raises the inevitable question, just what is he going to do next? Which brings me to the subject of this morning's lecture, whose title is First Principles, Building an Einstein Factory. When I first heard the title of Howard's lecture, I must confess, ladies and gentlemen, it struck me as rather preposterous. But pondering further, it finally hit me. The man has come up with a new and brilliant proposal, which in brief outline I imagine to be as follows. Instead of going to all the trouble of attracting scientists from around the world to come to Waterloo, in the unlikely hope that one of them might match Einstein's astonishing achievement, why not simply create an Einstein factory right here in Waterloo? This will involve, no doubt, some form of genetic engineering, by means of which Einstein clones will be manufactured, perhaps in the basement of this very building. The mind boggles. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the intrepid Howard Burton.
Thank you very much, Anthony. One of the many privileges of my position is that I occasionally have a few perks of the job, and one of them is to choose who I would like to introduce me. So I had the opportunity of choosing Anthony for several reasons. In the first case, Anthony is somebody who represents, in many ways, fundamental aspects of what this place is all about. He has a very lively and quick mind. He's quite broad, and he is extremely iconoclastic, as you might have picked up a little bit with some of his remarks. The second reason I wanted Anthony to introduce me is that I knew he would although I hadn't spoken to him beforehand, I knew he would give me a beautiful segue into what I wanted to talk about, which I'll approach in a moment. And the third reason that I wanted Anthony to introduce me is that it was an opportunity for me to get him up at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, which I don't think has ever happened before. So building an Einstein factory, indeed. Anthony says it's preposterous, the notion that we can actually have a factory that produces Einsteins. And he's absolutely right. It is a ridiculous idea. It was a title which perhaps wasn't given a great deal of forethought, and I apologize for that. And I thought a little bit more about what I'd like to speak about, and in the growing tradition of what we've been doing here at Einstein Fest, I told Michael Duchenne that I would take the liberty of talking about things that had very little to do with my abstract. That's actually quite a common theme during the festival for those who've been paying attention. This would be the comic relief part of the festival to just get you started. So what am I going to talk about? Well, there's a rigorous version of what I'm going to talk about, as you can see. So a description of the formation and founding motivations of this institute, complete with a retrospective, ad hoc, and highly conjectural analysis of what Einstein might think of its existence were he alive today, combined with a concluding assessment of the relevant likelihood of the institute producing the next Einstein. This is a question that I've been asked very, very frequently from the media over the past year. Well, where is the next Einstein, and how do you produce the next Einstein, and so forth? So I thought maybe I'd take a little bit of time to speculate on that, but it might be an interesting thing to do, to go through aspects of the history of this institute, try to get all of you a sense as to what was created and why, and then indulge in a speculation of what Einstein might think of it were he alive today, and back that up with a few quotes. So I apologize to Michael for veering off the topic, but I'm going to present in a good news, bad news scenario. I'm going to tell him that, unlike some of the other speakers who were at this festival, I will be very concrete in having a beginning, a middle, and an end. I will have a very strong structure, and to back up my structural orientations, I will also do some mathematical analysis. So at the end, you will know the score, as it were, that Einstein would give Perimeter Institute. A bold topic indeed. So here's the real version. What would Einstein say about Perimeter Institute? Well, Einstein, of course, is a very, very iconic figure. He's somebody who has motivated probably every single person who has ever taken a theoretical physics course. His legacy is huge. His orientation, his breadth of study, his impact throughout such a wide range of topics in theoretical physics is legendary. And his philosophical rigor, I think, is unparalleled. And one of the advantages of this year of physics is that I, like many, many other people, have actually had the opportunity to go back and look at his papers in 1905 and 1915 and so forth. And you see the hallmark of really an incredibly rigorous and insightful mind. So here's the structure of the talk, Michael. Here's the beginning, the introduction and structural preamble, which I'm in the middle of and will end very shortly. Then I will give you a brief history of the institute, how this institute came about, and I will culminate with four relevant factors, four aspects of this institute that I think distinguish it and are a product of the motivations of the very formulation and foundation of this institute. And then I will conclude, as promised, with Einstein's assessment of these four factors. I will give you a score. It's rather ad hoc, but I'll give it to you anyway. And then I'll speculate on this idea of the next Einstein. This is the end of the beginning. So let's move now to setting the stage. So what I call the passing of the buck and the foundations of quantum theory. So I did my undergraduate degree in the 80s. And the 80s was an interesting time in terms of education in physics. And it was a time when, if you were interested in foundational aspects of quantum theory, you were often consigned to either a lunatic asylum or a philosophy department, or sometimes both. And this is a natural thing for people to be interested in if they are foundationally motivated, if they're inclined, because quantum mechanics is a deeply mysterious topic. So what I call the passing of the buck refers to this notion as to, somewhat frustrating, at least for me, as to why go into physics to begin with. So you're constantly told when you're in school, if you're interested in biology and you probe the theories to a certain extent, they say, well, our theories break down here, you have to go look at chemistry. And then you go and you look at chemistry, and you talk about these various orbital clouds and S orbitals and P orbitals and so forth. And then at some point, if you keep asking questions, they say, well, our theories break down here, and you have to go look at physics. We can't really answer anymore. This is just what quantum mechanics tells you. So when you go to physics, there's this perception among physicists that this is where the buck stops. You can't just say, well, I'm sorry, we don't know. You have to get to the bottom of things. You have to have a deep understanding of what you know and what you don't know. And you can't just accept things ad hoc. Well, when I was an undergraduate, there was a spirit that was that really was quite different from that. And so I'll give you a few of the sort of standard quotes about quantum theory that I'm sure you've heard. So Niels Bohr, in arguably one of the most lucid quotes he's ever had, said that anybody who's not shocked by quantum mechanics hasn't fully understood it. This is an interesting quote. It's always tedious when people get up and read quotes, but I actually have a point behind this, so I will. David Merman wrote a quote, contemporary physicists come in two varieties. There are type 1 physicists who are bothered by EPR. This is the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen type of thought experiment that Einstein and his two collaborators came up with in 1935 when he was at the Institute for Advanced Study. And you've heard quite a bit about this before, so I won't bother going into any of the details. I'll just talk about the reactions. And Bell's theorem, which is correlated to that. So type 1 people are bothered by it. Type 2, who are the majority, are not. But one has to distinguish two sub-varieties of those. There are type 2A physicists who explain why they are not bothered, and their explanations tend either to miss the point entirely or to contain physical assertions that can be shown to be false. And then there are type 2B who are not bothered, but they refuse to explain why. And there's a further categorization, which are those who are not bothered and adamantly maintain that Niels Bohr figured it all out and stop there and don't say anything else. So John Bell, who perhaps had one of the most singular insights into the foundations of quantum theory, himself said that he's a professional theoretical physicist and he would like to make a clean theory, and when he looks at quantum mechanics, he sees a dirty theory. So lots of people were bothered by this. And it was very disconcerting to be an undergraduate and to be in an environment where people just don't take this stuff seriously at all. On the other hand, there are good reasons why people don't take it seriously. And Richard Feynman was perhaps one of the most active proponents of the view of let's get on with things. And Richard Feynman did, of course, exactly that and gave rise to tremendous insights into the physical world by his belief that one just has to move beyond a lot of the difficulties of quantum theory. And after he says nobody understands quantum mechanics, he says, don't keep asking yourself, how can it possibly be like that, because you will effectively go down the drain. This is an interesting quote that I found as a hallmark to that effect. So Steven Weinberg says that he was with a colleague, and his conversation turned to a young theorist who had been quite promising as a graduate student and who had then dropped out of sight. I asked Phil what had interfered with the ex-student's research, and Phil shook his head sadly and said, he tried to understand quantum mechanics. So there are two streams of thought. There are the people who are upset that these foundational questions aren't being taken seriously. And then there are those very eminent physicists who think, well, okay, they're questions, they're issues, but you can't become obsessed with this because there's lots out there that we don't understand and you have to keep moving forwards. And there was a bit of a rift at the time. So I found that it was important for me to, I think I'm giving our AV guys trouble because I keep getting closer and closer to the mic, so I'll try to stay in one spot. I found that this represented a real intellectual impasse for me, and as Anthony mentioned in his very kind introduction, I moved over to philosophy because the philosophers were asking a lot of questions that the physicists weren't even asking. And when I was doing my undergraduate work in quantum theory, nobody asked nobody even talked about foundational issues. You couldn't even talk about Bell's theory. You couldn't talk about that at all. Quantum theory was just this algorithmic thing, and it was extremely unsatisfying. So when I walked over to the philosophy department, I found that people were asking all these questions, and it was wonderful. It was like an intellectual renaissance. The difficulty was that while they asked a lot of questions, the vast majority of them couldn't answer the questions. So you found yourself in this weird in-between world where you had people who weren't asking questions that were really exciting, and then you moved to another place where people were asking these questions but didn't have the necessary rigor to be able to address them. So from that, I thought, well, if I really want to understand these things, maybe I should go back to physics after all, and that led me over to London. And when I was in London, I was strongly influenced by a set of lectures that I took by Chris Isham, as it happens, who subsequently, for those of you who are keeping score of this sort of thing, actually wound up on our scientific advisory committee. And Chris was somebody who was the first person I had met, a theoretical physicist with an incredible amount of mathematical rigor, who took these foundational questions very, very seriously. And from him, I also learned that mathematics, the standard game in theoretical physics, is mathematics is just a tool. Elegant mathematics basically takes a physical understanding of a result and eliminates a proof of 20 lines and makes it 3 lines. That's sort of the way a physicist looks at mathematics. But I think that things are a lot deeper than that, and Chris was certainly somebody who highlighted that to me. So I resolved that when I would have the opportunity, I would go back and do a PhD, and I would explore these aspects of the physical world, these deep mathematical truths and underpinnings, and try to push things to a different, well, in my understanding, to a different level. But of course, I was getting older, and I started to understand a little bit how the sociological factors work, and how things work in terms of getting a job in physics, the likelihood of getting a permanent position, the requirement of doing a tremendous number of different postdocs all over the world, and the idea of living like a penurious postdoc and spending 2 years here and 1 year there and trying to slave out an existence and so forth didn't strike me at this point as perhaps the most intelligent thing that I could be doing. So I made a deal with myself, and I said, I'll just take a sabbatical from the real world, I'll do a PhD, I'll learn something interesting, and then I'll have to go back and pay my bills like everybody else. So that was the deal I made with myself, and it proved to be a good deal, and I had a great deal of enjoyment and intellectual satisfaction from doing the PhD. But when I was studying the PhD, I realized that there were some other aspects sociologically that were very curious. There were these groups of people who were pursuing foundational aspects of theoretical physics. I'm not talking necessarily about quantum theory now. I'm talking about unification of quantum mechanics and general relativity, so-called quantum gravity. There were all these different camps of people who were ostensibly doing the same sort of thing. They were pursuing the same sorts of issues at a deep foundational level. But they weren't talking to one another. Worse, they were spitting across barriers to one another. And I thought, this is really silly in some deep, profound sense, because everybody's trying to understand these questions. There's not a lot of money at stake. There's not a lot of fame or women or anything like that. You would think that there would be at least some spirit of open intellectual exchange. After all, that's what an academic environment is supposed to be all about. But I noticed there was a tremendous amount of local intolerance. Okay. So I noticed these things, and you notice things. Fine. So that's all right. I had to go out. I did the PhD. I was going to get a job, as Mr. Einstein says. And as Anthony mentioned, I applied in mathematical finance. Now, that may strike some of you as a little bit odd, but this was during the late 1990s, and certainly throughout the 1990s, a tremendous number of people who were trained in the mathematical sciences got a job in mathematical finance, because there was a natural fit there. There was money to be made. You could have a standard of living above that of your average field mouse, which is what academics were making, and it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. So I was fortunate enough, after hustling around, to get an opportunity to pursue something in Wall Street. And this was in 1999, and before I did that, I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm just not being creative enough. After all, 1999, everybody was getting rich, right? People were IPOing ideas, and many of them were just stupid ideas, but they were getting wealthy, and I thought, I'm a smart guy. I should be able to do something that's a little bit different. So I wrote to various companies, This is a story that some of you have heard. I apologize. I'll try to make it as quick as possible. I wrote to various companies, and I thought maybe I could do something better than living in New Jersey and working in a hedge fund in Manhattan and being in a cubicle or something like that. And I wrote to the CEOs of the companies directly because I knew that if I wrote to human resources, they'd say, you're not a software engineer or this or that. And I wrote to them, and I gave them this letter, this standard letter of supplication and treaty, and I said, here I am, I'm this wonderful person, I have all these great skills, I have a PhD in theoretical physics, I have a master's in philosophy, for God's sakes, I have communication skills galore, please help save me from a lucrative career in finance. And I think I may have mentioned Solus as well. And some of them wrote back, but the most interesting person in response was Mike Lazaridis, who was, of course, heading up this company, Research in Motion, one of two CEOs. As it happens, I wrote to both of them. I had no idea of any of them. And he said, we started talking over the phone, and he said, well, you can always work at RIM, but I've just got something else I'm thinking about, kicking around, and maybe we can talk. So started talking. We met in Brampton. We went to a restaurant after Mike gave a talk at Nortel. And he started talking to me. And it quickly became apparent to me that he didn't have anything in mind, really. He was talking about all sorts of things. Communications, he was interested in thinking about new forms of communications, he was all over the map. It was part science, it was part science fiction, it was heavily speculative, and I was nodding my head a lot. I thought, okay, you know, whatever. And every so often he'd say, you know, physics is really important, and science is really important, and basically, and I said, yeah, well, you know, I got my PhD, I believe in it, obviously, but I don't know what you're talking about. And part of that, in retrospect, is that Mike is a very intuitive guy. He has a really very good physical intuition, and he bounces a lot of ideas around before he has a clear understanding of what he's doing. And his view was really quite different. His view was, look, I wound up winning the lottery. BlackBerry had been released in 1999, earlier that very same year. The company had gone public in 97. The company had started in 84. He found himself all of a sudden with all this money. And he's a reasonable guy. He's a decent man. He's not somebody who wants to spend his time buying sports franchises and so forth. And he wants to use his money. Not that people who buy sports franchises are bad people, of course. But he wants to use his money. He believes very strongly in almost the obligation for people who have that amount of wealth to do something interesting with it. So he was thinking, I've got this money, I want to do something interesting with it. He gets this bizarre letter from this guy who's asking him to help save him from a lucrative career in Wall Street, and he thinks, physicist, that's interesting, physics is interesting, I've always been excited, let's talk. So we're talking at this restaurant, and at some point, after this conversation goes on and on for a couple of hours, and as I told my wife later, I'm looking for the exits because I'm thinking this guy was just completely crazy. And if I had not been the one who actually approached him, I probably would have bolted. And he turns to me in the middle of this and he says, so are you interested? and I say, interested in what? And he doesn't respond, and he goes down. And he writes a number down on a napkin, and he hands me the napkin. I don't know what the hell's going on. And then I realize, oh, this is the salary negotiation part of this bizarre exercise. So I look at this number, and it's some entry-level number. Okay, fine. And I say sure because I can't take it seriously at all. So he says great, and then we pause. We don't say anything for a while. A few minutes go by, and I say, so what do you want me to do? Do you want me to write reports about things? What do you want me to do? I don't want you to do anything, he says. I just want you to think. Okay. I can do that. And he said, I know the way this works. There'll be all sorts of things that will happen, and now's your chance to sit down and think, which in retrospect turned out to be absolutely right. So I go out, and I phone my wife, and I say, I think I have a job. And she says, what do you mean you think you have a job? And you had a job, and what about this wall? No, it's completely different. Met this guy, he gave me a napkin, different story altogether. different thing. Oh, she says, so what do you have to do for this job? I have to think, I say. So we laugh about that, and it's obviously very hard to take seriously. But Mike's not a stupid guy, and a couple days later, I get an advanced check by courier in the mail for this ridiculously low salary that I stupidly agreed to so quickly. And I think, oh my God, this is really serious. I better start thinking. So I started thinking. And I was living in the Beaches at the time, in Toronto, for those of you who know, and I'm walking up and down along the boardwalk, and I'm thinking, because I'm getting paid to think. And first thing I think of is, well, we should think of something to call this thing. And so after about 20 minutes or so, I'm walking, I think, okay, well, let's do something a little different, let's be on the edge, thinking about edges, cutting edge, that sort of thing. And then I'm thinking, well, perimeter, and then you've got the Anglo-Greek thing, right? You've got Perimeter Institute, which is pi, and that refers to the wonderful lineage of foundational thinking from the ancient Greeks, and so it's got some nice tradition and history there. And of course, Mike is originally of Greek descent. That's interesting. It's got Research in Motion, RIM, in the name. Not too obvious. Well, it's an interesting name. We can just use it as a working title. So that's the idea. I email Mike and I say, what about this? Sure, he says, fine. And the implication was that we'd always go back at some point and we'd have some rigorous discussion. But very much in keeping with what he said at the beginning, we never really had a chance to do any rigorous discussion about a lot of these things. And the lawyers got a hold of it. And as lawyers tend to do, they started incorporating documents with this. And before we knew it, we were Perimeter Institute, and that was that. Okay. More significantly, I started thinking about some of the sociology, some of institutes around the world, and what they had done, and what they were like, and so forth. And a common and obvious example of an institute which is relevant, at least as a starting point for a model, is the Institute for Advanced Study, which I'm just going to talk about very, very briefly. And then I'm going to talk about making a difference and how that led to these 4 points. So this is the Institute for Advanced Study, or a picture of it in Princeton, New Jersey. This is the story of a very abbreviated story of the Institute for Advanced Study is that Louis Bamberger and his sister, Catherine Bamberger Fold, sold out their department store shortly before the stock market crash in 1929, a few weeks before, and they sold to Macy's, as it happens. And they had a tremendous amount of money at the time, something of the order of $30 million. And this gentleman, Abraham Flexner, who was an educator, and who had written some scathing treatise on scurrilous medical stuff. In fact, he wrote a few books on American colleges and on medical school shams, basically. He exposed a great number of medical schools in America and in Canada. And he was a very rigorous thinker, and he believed very strongly in the importance of education, but in the value of a quality education. And he came to meet these wealthy patrons, and of course he had been thinking about educational institutions, and he thought, wouldn't it be great, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could build a place that was devoted just to foundational thinking, almost to this platonic heaven, if you will. And so he convinced his patrons that this is what they should do, and he built this place in Princeton, New Jersey, and in fact they had temporary facilities at Princeton University for several years, and the school opened, or the institute opened in 1933. And here's a sense of what I was alluding to before about Flexner's view of the importance of a free society of scholars. So this should be something which is not driven in any way by application, which has no direct relevance necessarily to the physical world. It's just pure scholarship, pure knowledge, pure basic research, unfettered intellectual inquiry, all the rest of this. And it's this ideal, pristine, platonic place. And he was, I guess from a recruitment perspective, it's a horrible thing to say, but he was fortunate in the sense that he could do two things. He had a great deal of intellectual capital who were leaving the ravages of Nazi Europe and the horrible oppression that was happening there. And he also had the Princeton mathematics department, which he was able to raid. So the combination enabled him to start off with these four famous faculty members in what was then the School of Mathematics. And Albert Einstein was one of them, as you have heard. So this was, insofar as we have an institution which was one of a kind, was endowed, was devoted to pure scholarship and pure thinking, well, that's an obvious parallel. It's something to be thinking about if one is thinking about the idea of building an institute. Now, of course, the world was very different in 1930 when this institute was founded than in 1999. Not only because of the political dynamics and so forth, but also because there was no place like the Institute for Advanced Study in 1930. And now, of course, not only are there so many strong research universities throughout North America and Europe and so forth that focus on a lot of these areas, but there's also the Institute for Advanced Study itself, in addition to other standalone institutions. So the obvious question is, what do we have to do in 1999 to build a place in recognition of the dynamics of the day, which is different? How do we make a difference, given that the climate is really quite changed, of course, several years later? What would be appropriate for us in Waterloo, Ontario, given the certain circumstances that we live in, to do? So I break this up, and here's where I get into the clearer delineation part of the talk, into from a research perspective and from a cultural operations perspective. So from a research perspective, first and foremost, there's no point in creating something which is not at the highest possible level, whatever you do. You don't want to create something which is mediocre. There's no real reason to spend a lot of money or a lot of time or a lot of effort to create a mediocre theoretical physics institution. The world is not hungering for such objects. And you also have to be careful not to believe your own press. You don't want to be too parochial. You don't want to be internationally renowned throughout southwestern Ontario or something like that. If you really want to be at the highest level, you want to do something at the highest level. But you also want to be different in sociological reasons. And I alluded to some of the things that have troubled me personally that obviously played a role in this. There's another aspect to it, what I call the cultural and operational side of things. There is the fact that science and research is not fully appreciated in this society. And that's something which I've certainly found mystifying, that as we move into a greater and greater technologically sophisticated age, it seems, I don't know, I'm not a sociologist, although I'm getting dangerously close, it seems as if people have less and less understanding and regard for science and the scientific method. This is something which Mike feels very passionately about, and so it was natural for us to consider not only building an interesting institute that would address scientific needs, but also using this as a bully pulpit to be able to distribute to the world our concerns about the importance of research and the importance of science and its neglect in our society. So, after I met Mike, things started moving very quickly, as he surmised, and after a few weeks of walking up along the beach and thinking, we appointed a board of directors for the Institute, and I was adamant that it was vitally important for me to travel and talk to people at different institutes around the world, people at the faculty level, people at the administrative level, ask them all sorts of questions about their institutions, ranging from how their organizational structure works, their management structure, their areas of research focus, their interaction with the surrounding university, their architecture, what they would do differently if they could do something again, if they could rebuild their structure. And I got a lot of interesting answers, a lot of interesting responses, some of which contradicted each other, but not all. I also had the opportunity to ask people at the time who they might recommend as prospective faculty members as well as research areas, and whether or not, depending on who they were, they may or may not be motivated to help us and sit on an advisory committee that we have. And again, I was I was basically extremely pleased and impressed by the response that I had garnered, because after all, who was I? I was this little guy who nobody had heard of, who was wandering around to research institutions around the world and talking to some of the most eminent scientists alive and saying to them, I'm going to build a research institute in Waterloo, Ontario. And I think you have to appreciate the fact that it's not that infrequent that physicists get approached by people who are crazy. It happens a surprising number of times. People come up and I've got a perpetual motion machine in my basement that you have to see, all this kind of stuff. So the skepticism was actually quite high, but they were willing to meet with me, and it was an interesting experience because we had to be very careful in terms of confidentiality. And the reason why is that if rumors would have got out that the CEO of RIM was starting to give all sorts of money away, these things can escalate. The tech climate was, of course, under a microscope, and the stock was going up and the stock was going down. And if people were to have got the wrong impression, Mike was losing his mind, or he thought that quantum gravity was important for immediate applications to cell phones or whatever it is, then there'd be a run on the stock. So we had to be very careful. So I went into these meetings. They were actually quite amusing. And although people hadn't heard of me and their skepticism was high, they'd have the meeting with me, and I was on trial, basically. And I did this very, very often. So I got used to the sort of standard format. So I'd sit down and I'd talk to these people, and I'd say, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I'm interested in, and this is what I'd like. I'd like your opinion on this and your feedback on that and this and that and up and down. And you could see the way that their minds would shift after you talked to them. They say, OK, well, the guy seems to know a little bit. He understands aspects of physics, clearly. We're living in an age when people have a lot of money. A lot of these people come from the science and engineering sector. It's not so unreasonable. It's fine. And by the end of the conversation, which normally took between 45 minutes and an hour, they were normally sold. And they thought, OK, this is all pretty reasonable. And moreover, the brighter ones could recognize, hey, this could happen here, too. We could get money for our institution or our university from people like this. And things got quite engaged. And they would turn to me, and they said, so who's behind all this? Where's the money coming from? And I said, I can't tell you. Voom! All of a sudden, my credibility just died. But I got an awful lot of information. And at some level, the board made recommendations back to the board, and we had a few conclusions as to how we would structure the institute and what we would do. So we wanted to create an atmosphere where foundational issues can be addressed. Real foundational issues can be rigorously addressed from a variety of perspectives. So we don't fall into this sociological hole, as it were, where we say, no, we only want to do this particular thing. And this happens, I think, there are several reasons why it could be argued that this perhaps happens more today than in some other times. And that is that many aspects of foundational physics are further away from experiment than they've ever been. Not all, of course, but many. And so it's always difficult to become, experiment is the great arbiter of physics, and if you don't have experiments that are readily accessible, you get naturally arising cliques and clans and people who are perhaps more rigidly maintaining the validity of their theory based on mathematical reasons alone. And if you look at the sociology, you have to realize that historically in science, outsiders, it is not infrequent that outsiders have made some just remarkable contributions. So Alan Guth, who was the founder of cosmological inflation, was almost out of a job and was looking desperately. John Schwartz, who should not have a T in his name, and I apologize for that, with Michael Green, were founders of superstring theory. And if it wasn't for the largesse and the determination of Murray Gell-Mann at Caltech, he would have been out of a job and might have been on Wall Street or somewhere else. Albert Einstein, of course, when he was, and I'm not trying to make an equivalence, unfortunately, between myself and John Schwartz, who's much smarter than I am, but Albert Einstein, as you've been hearing for the last 3 weeks, was an unknown, unheralded patent clerk in Bern, and nobody in the scientific community would have bet on revolutions in physics in 1904 coming from anywhere near there. So you have to be very careful, and you have to recognize that there are an awful lot of historical examples of this sort of thing. Of people from the outside. You can't put all your eggs in one basket. That being said, you have to also be very careful, because there are an awful lot of people who have made extremely impressive discoveries and accomplishments in theoretical physics who were very much in the mainstream. So the same Mr. Einstein, by the time he had his general theory of relativity that Anthony alluded to, was very much a very well-respected icon in the field and was a full professor. I just mentioned a few. There are more. And you have to understand that you have to have a balance. Okay? And then for completeness, just to drill home this idea of necessary and sufficient, I put up three other people whom you haven't heard of because they haven't done anything, or they're crazy. Okay? So the lesson to be learned is you have to be careful. Just being outside of the mainstream doesn't mean it's meritorious, right? You have to have a balance, and you have to use a lot of good judgment, and you need some good assistant to be able to make sure that you're prudent, you have a big enough tent, but you're not the wacky institute, right? Or the Institute for Lost Causes. You certainly don't want to do that. So it's a very careful balance. Conclusion two. Well, we focus on foundational issues, foundational physics. But as I mentioned before, you have to make sure, especially in this day and age, to represent the fact that you're a physics institute and you're not a mathematics institute. So you have to make sure that you have a balance between what I call formal mathematical approaches to foundational questions, which are formal and mathematical for all sorts of very good reasons. I'm not impugning them by saying that. But you're not just a mathematics institute. You have real physics and a real balance between those two agendas. You have ties to the physical world. You have people discussing, if not direct experiments, what might be experimentally verifiable. So how has this led to some aspects of the research areas that we have? Well, we do, on the formal side, we do quantum gravity from a variety of different perspectives. We do canonical approaches, we do string theoretic approaches, and we certainly are unique here, or at least we were at the time, of a place that was boldly determined to pursue some of these ideas simultaneously. We do foundations of quantum theory, but we also do this thing called quantum information theory, and that's very interesting, because I mentioned the climate in the 1980s. And how it was very much opposed to foundational issues in quantum mechanics. Well, that changed. And one of the reasons it changed, in fact, the principal reason it changed, was there was a new way of looking at foundational issues in quantum theory called quantum information theory. There was a marriage between quantum mechanics and the information theory of computer science. And this not only gave rise to a different perspective and a different way of looking at quantum mechanics, it also gave rise to a litany of quantum engineering and quantum technologies in terms of quantum computers and quantum cryptography and so forth. Now, that's not to say that everybody who believes in foundational approaches to quantum theory believes that quantum information theory is necessarily the way to go. And my esteemed introducer this morning is a case in point of that particular view. But there are many who do. And perhaps more significantly from a sociological perspective, it meant that people could look at things like EPR and Bell and foundational issues of quantum theory in a different context, and it wasn't anathema anymore to be discussing such concepts, quite the contrary. And so it did quite a bit to rejuvenate many of these areas and push it forwards, because after all, there was a certain sense where, however important people recognized that they were, the foundational aspects of quantum theory weren't making a tremendous amount of progress in 70 years. And so this came as a welcome change to a great many people. So on the one side, we have these formal areas. On the other side, we have particle physics, cosmology, which is, and you'll be hearing much more about cosmology from a very eminent cosmologist, Paul Steinhardt, who'll be giving a talk very shortly. And this is an exciting field, not only because of its intellectual rigor and of course, the subject matter itself, but also there's a tremendous amount of data that's now out there, and there are a tremendous amount of opportunities to really say something significant from an experimental perspective. So the idea of establishing this balance is we have quantum information theory with experimental possibilities and foundational aspects. We have elementary particle physics with naturally experimental avenues, especially as the new accelerator comes online in a few years at CERN. We have cosmology, we have possibly other related areas, and we have the more formal approaches. That's conclusion two. And here are some of the people who were recruited to the Institute who represent aspects of what it is that I'm talking about. So on the left, we have Lee Smolin, and in the center, we have Rob Myers. And these are two individuals who were founding members of the Institute who represent different views and foundational aspects of quantum gravity. Both of them are very well regarded and esteemed in their own particular avenues, but they are people who represent this notion of harboring different approaches to foundational issues. On the right, I have Raymond Laflamme, who not only came from a not only he's a quantum information theorist who has made significant accomplishments in the theory of quantum information. He is now an experimentalist in quantum information theory. And before that, he had a quantum gravity background, being a student of Stephen Hawking. So he fit the culture here as well. And at the end of the day, whatever conclusions you come to and whatever your broad framework is, you have to make sure that you have people who can drive it forwards. Because at the end of the day, that's all that matters, and all the rest is just a bunch of hot air. So that's on the research side. What about on this cultural operations side of things? Well, somehow I say we should obtain and maintain strong government support. So one question that you might ask, physicists don't ask this question, but you might, is why? Why do you want stronger? I mean, after all, Mike gave all this money, two of his colleagues gave more money, $120 million. Gosh, surely that's enough. Well, the answer is no, it's not enough. It's not enough from an operations perspective because you build an endowment. And you might want to make sure you capitalize on that and don't drain down the endowment. But even more significantly, it's not enough from a moral perspective, because it's important to get the stamp of approval of the federal government and the provincial government to say, we want to support this, we're behind this. That gives you credibility to go out and recruit. After all, the governments support basic research anyway, and if they wouldn't support the sort of research that we're doing, that would be a statement in and of itself. And that would make it very difficult for us to say, yes, we're a recognized institution, and where we're supported here, we would just be the plaything of a bunch of rich guys, basically, in Waterloo. And that would make it very difficult for us to achieve not only culturally, but scientifically. Well, it's interesting to note that, just as an aside, in the beginning of all of this, things changed, because none of us really knew what we were doing. And in fact, Mike's original plan, or when we started talking about it, was, well, I want to spend the money in 30 years. $100 million in 30 years, he said. So I said, no, you don't want to do that. No, I want to do it. 30 years, 30-year project, spend the money. No, I said, you don't want it. But it's my money, I want to spend it. No, sorry. Why did we say that? It wasn't just me, it was other people on the board. Well, because I told them, if you have a 30-year project, how the heck are you going to recruit people in year 25? How are you going to recruit people in year 20? In fact, academics being the way they are, how are you going to recruit people in year 2? Because they're going to say, oh no, that's a time-limited project. It's important from a financial perspective, 30 years is almost infinite if you can manage it properly. So it's really important for us if we are to have the resources to be one of the best, if not the best place in the world in what we do, to be able to marshal all our resources and use them as well as we possibly can. We were fortunate enough eventually to be able to get very strong government support from both the federal and provincial levels. It wasn't easy. The last conclusion that we came to was, alluding to what I said before, or directly corresponding to what I said before, we're a physics institute, but this entire place was put together with an idea that there is a problem that we would like to address in society, that people don't appreciate research, they don't appreciate science, they're not as engaged as they should be. And at the very beginning, I recognized that, well, it's easy to blame people for that, or blame television for that, or blame all sorts of things for that. It's not entirely clear who's really to blame. And I started off a few years ago, and I told people, I want to run public lectures on a monthly basis on issues of science and society in Waterloo. And they said, Howard, you are out of your mind. There is no way that you can run lectures on science and society on a monthly basis in a town the size of Kitchener-Waterloo and expect to get more than 30 or 35 people coming to your talks, and half of them will be criminally insane. And I said, no, I don't think so. And here's why. There's evidence for this. Go look at the New York Times bestseller list, and go see how long A Brief History of Time has been there. It's been setting records all over the place. This is a physics book. Yes, you don't want to, you know, have lectures on quantum theory every single month, or lectures on cosmology or whatever. You have to vary the format and so forth. But if people have a hunger for this, people want to know, people have always wanted to know, for God's sakes. Ever since we could crawl out of our caves, we wanted to know what was out there. We wanted to be engaged. It's a natural part of the human condition. Our job is not to just bitch about how gosh, people aren't smart enough or they're not engaged enough. Our job is to give them good programming. Vary it, make it interesting, make it non-intimidating for people who have horrible memories of their grade 11 physics teacher. Fine. Make it interesting, make it exciting, tap into that, vary it. So, this led to our mission statement, which is too long to read, so I won't, but suffice it to say that it encapsulates many of the aspects that I've been talking about today, and if you want to read it, I would direct you to our website where it is prominently displayed somewhere, I hope, at perimeterinstitute.ca. This is interesting because this is the initial report from our scientific advisory committee. So our committee has met 5 times now, and on the first time, they recognize the importance and the potential of this place. And so I will read at least aspects of this. So it's a remarkably bold experiment. Its mission is tightly focused on research on fundamental physics, on the development of a highly interactive, tightly knit community of colleagues. It's distinguished by a major financial commitment, which is directed towards a small but highly influential scientific field. PI has, I'm dropping down, the potential to become the most important new privately funded institute in theoretical physics since the founding of the Institute for Advanced Study 70 years ago. So here we have an endorsement from the advisory committee, who is, you know, they're not without some degree of skepticism, they're not without their own concerns, they're not saying that everything is certainly rosy on all fronts necessarily, but they understand and respect and are excited by the potential that this place has, and they are committed to doing what they can to make it achieve its lofty goals, and we are extremely grateful for them. This, Michael, is the end of the middle. Now I'm moving on. What would Einstein say? So this is the highly conjectural part. I'm not going to have time to go through all of these quotes, so I'll skim them through. But what I have done is I have assembled these 4 points. I have assembled quotes by Einstein, and I have given a score of, given what Einstein has said, how he would evaluate our 4 fundamental aspects of our mission, and I would use his own words. And of course, the advantage of doing this is that Mr. Einstein, however wonderful an individual he was in life, is no longer living, so he can't refute what it is that I'm saying. So, the first one to do with foundational physics and creating, what was the first one again? Yes, different perspectives and so forth, orthodox and unorthodox in foundational physics. So here is what Einstein said about orthodoxy. He was a noted iconoclast, as you've all, of course, discovered from this festival. Here is one of the ones that I actually really enjoy. this is something that he said about youth and the importance of youth. This was his view of how he was regarded at the Institute for Advanced Study. And I think speaks to his spirit and, again, his iconoclastic temperament. This is his view of the importance of foundational physics, fundamental physics. Many of you have probably seen many of these quotes before. So, I think there's a strong overlap there. So I give it 24 out of 25. Here's conclusion 2. Okay, the difference between mathematical approaches and more approaches that are more directly relevant to experiment. So this is an interesting quote for the physicists among you. In terms of Einstein, I find it interesting at any rate. His view of physics versus philosophy and how far philosophy can go and physical intuition. This is a manual for what physicists should stick to. Again, the importance of experiment in the physical world. And however his mathematical flights of fancy, Einstein was very, very grounded in the physical world and was certainly not a believer in mathematics for mathematics' sake. more of the same. This is an interesting one again, which shows you Einstein's belief in physics rather than mathematics. So he's a real physicist. Mathematics is nice, it's useful, it's important, but at the end of the day, it's reality we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen. This is, as you read this, I'll just mention, this is an assessment of Einstein's determination to unify forces and come up with an overall comprehensive framework. Now, there are, as you've heard, there are all sorts of issues with Einstein's belief or lack of belief in quantum theory, which precluded him from coming up with a unified field theory. But it's important to note, as Brian Greene and many other people have noted, that Einstein's quest, his belief in this unification, is still very much alive today in a somewhat different form, of course, in a modern form. And many people believe there's been a revision of some of the assessments that have been made on Einstein, not so much that he was wasting his time at the Institute for Advanced Study in his later years, which papers like the EPR paper also fly in the face of, but that he, in many ways, was ahead of his time. Not in all, but in many. So there's a strong overlap there, so we get 23 out of 25 from that as well. Now we move on to getting government support. So this is harder. If you look for quotes, Einstein, as you know, didn't just stick to physics. He talked a good deal about international relations. He was living, as mentioned previously, in an extremely turbulent time. He was a refugee from the Nazis, as were so many other physicists and scientists and humanists and people. He had strong views about global governance. He had strong views about democracy. He had strong views about Zionism, about Israel. He did not, so far as I can determine, and I've scoured the quotation areas as best I can, have any strong views about government support of physics. But he did say a few things about politics, which I'm going to use to buttress my argument. And he talks about the importance, and maybe I take this to heart a little bit from a more administrative context. He talks about the balance between politics and science and how much time one should spend on each. Now, of course, when he's talking about politics, he's talking about something else. But he's not here now, so we can use his words. So I gave us a passing mark on this one because I think that at the end of the day, Einstein would be sympathetic to the idea that these are meritorious activities, and he believed very passionately and strongly in science, and he believed in a democracy, and so thus he would believe, I argue twistedly, in lobbying democratically elected governments for funds to do something meritorious. But I have no real support, so I give us just a barely passing mark on that one. In terms of outreach programs and his belief in the importance of spreading the word of science, we're on much firmer grounds. So by outreach, of course, Einstein not only believed in passionately transmitting the joy and fun and wonder and mystery of science to the world at large, and he was exemplary in terms of his ability and his motivation to respond to letters by children. As you've heard earlier in the festival, he was a very avid letter writer, and particularly he would almost always respond to children when they would ask him questions. He believed that it was certainly part of his duty and obligation as an authority figure because of his fame to be promulgating the importance of physics and the importance of science. He also believed in arts and culture, and he often didn't make as much distinction in terms of intellectual activity. Clearly they were different domains, but he believed they were both meritorious. And so here are some of the famous quotes that we have for Einstein. And he relished his fame. I think at some point I'm sure it was inconvenient to him, but he clearly enjoyed it to a large extent, and he used it. And he was quite famous for his pronouncements on this sort of thing. This is an interesting quote I found in terms of his sympathy and his sense of the relevance of influencing people of a younger generation. Perhaps he was just referring to the fact that he was fed up dealing with some of his older colleagues. It's hard to tell. He wrote many things about education, and most of them were pretty scathing. There is this myth that Einstein was a bad student, and as has been exploded many times during the course of these 3 weeks, that's not in fact the case. He was, by and large, an extremely good student. What he was occasionally an extremely indifferent student when he was forced to do rote learning and when he was forced to be subjected to the anachronistic and often pointless learning process that was inflicted on him in various stages of his life when he was younger. He rebelled against that and was a self-taught individual. Contemporary education. So this is an interesting quote. Contemporary was, of course, in Einstein's time, but it's not clear that that's not applicable today also. I mention music because, again, by cultural outreach, we have a broader mandate here. Obviously, we're motivated to promulgate the importance and the joy and the mystery and wonder of scientific discovery. But as you know, we do things a great deal more, and we try to break down barriers and at least entice people into contemplating other areas of meritorious intellectual activity or social activity or what have you, music being one of them. Einstein was very famous for his love of the violin and his love of classical music. And so there is this quote. So I think we've done well here as well. So I've given us 22 out of 25. It's hard to get a complete match, but I think we've done very well. So on the whole, my arguably ludicrous but nonetheless pseudo-academic conjecture as to what Einstein would think of Perimeter Institute and its orientation, we get 82 out of 100, which I think is pretty good at the end of the day. So, I promised you a few words about the next Einstein, which is something that people are constantly asking me and everybody else about. Just like an Einstein factory, I think this is also a really silly question. But it's silly in the sense that, so why is it silly? It's silly in the sense that you can say, oh yes, we are going to produce the next Einstein here, or we have some secret sauce or secret formula to producing the next Einstein. And often things get trivialized in that particular way. What I think at the same time is not silly is, as I hope I've successfully explained to you, there is a sense in which this institute was motivated towards encouraging people of a disposition that Einstein largely shared. And not only through our encouragement of certain scientific questions and orientations and attitudes and proclivities and so forth, but also through the outreach program. Because at the end of the day, if you look back at the success of Perimeter Institute, who's to say if the greatest success will happen through a research breakthrough that happens at the institute because of one of the people we've recruited to this institute, or a conference that happens to be held here, or a visitor who comes here and interacts? Or who's to say if it won't happen through some 10-year-old girl who's in Cambridge right now, who gets inspired and gets interested in what it is that we're doing, and who might come up with the next breakthrough? Who's to say? So, this is a quote that I threw in because I think it's silly to speculate. So this is an emphatic quote by Einstein. This is something that I put in because I personally have the belief that Niels Bohr and Yogi Berra are really the same person. And lastly, I'll just say one thing, which is that you can't tautologically, one of Einstein's greatest, let me back up that whole sentence again, one of Einstein's perhaps most notable characteristics is his stubbornness, his belief in himself, his iconoclasm. You can't grow iconoclasts. By definition, you can't grow iconoclasts. and this is, you know, this is what they do to you, right? So that's the end of the end. Thank you very much. Thank you. And since I've done this before, Michael told me that I can take my own questions. So I will. And we don't have very much. What do we have? 5 minutes or so? 5 minutes. So if anybody has a question, I'd be happy. Yes. Oh, there's supposed to be the microphone people who come by so that everybody else can hear the question. So just if you could just hold on one moment, microphone person will come by. This increases the dramatic tension of the question.
Is the rate at which the scientists here at the Institute publishing papers, is it meeting your expectations, the rate at which the scientists are producing publishing papers?
Let me not hit that question head on, and let me say, so broadly, yeah, sure, broadly yes is the answer, but let me say that there are all sorts of ways, let me reframe the question, if I may, and try to respond as best I can. So a question I get asked a lot is, well, how do you know you've had success? How do you measure success of this place scientifically? How do you measure success? And there are all sorts of different, you know, different aspects of the mandate, but scientifically, how do you measure success? And there are all sorts of ways of measuring success, and there are standard metrics and non-standard metrics. And in the standard metrics, you have the number of publications, you have the citations according to the, as well, you have the number of conferences that you hold here, you have you have to be very careful. I mean, citations, the idea of citations as opposed to number of publications is that you're looking for the impact that such work has had. But of course, even that can sometimes be misleading, because often you get a group of like-minded people who may be spinning their wheels somewhere, and they're citing each other like crazy, and they're publishing like crazy for a lot of sociological reasons. So that's the worst case scenario. Of course, sometimes that's completely different from that. So you have to be careful not to confuse the number of publications with the impact of the publications, or the depth of the publications. And all too often you have people who are publishing perhaps more than they should. That being said, of course you want people to publish, and of course it's a sign of an active research career. So you have to look at it in the broader sense. Basically, yes. I should mention that we started research operations, which I didn't mention here, in 2001. So, and we've been ramping up pretty steadily. So it's awfully hard to really get a rigorous, objective sense of what we've done, given our growth curve and so forth. But broadly, yes. But there are issues with respect to how foundational people should be and how frequently they should publish. So there's that complicating factor. Then there's another aspect to this institute, or to any institute, which I think has to be taken into account. So those standard metrics are important, and they should be the dominant terms of the equation, how productive you are by the standard rates of research, no question. But there's also another aspect of this place, or any place, which is less tangible but just as important to evaluate. And that is, if there's a sense of a buzz, if there's a sense of people think, you know, this place is really, I want to go there, I'm interested in going there, wow, this is a great experience, I went here for a week or I went there for 2 weeks and I did some great science. And every different institution has its own character and they have their own place. And it could well be that, I'm not talking about this place in particular, but some place may be a place that is seen as being extremely dynamic, and maybe at the end of the day it serves science better by the quality and the impact of the work that comes out of some visitors who come. Or, you know, there are all sorts of ways of skinning a cat. It's hard to just say, well, look, our faculty, we have N faculty and they have Y publications, and therefore we're proceeding at, you know, X rate. It's important to look at it that way, but it's important to look at it in a much broader context. But broadly, yes, is the short answer. There's a question up in the middle. I guess that's it, eh? That's the last question. Sorry, I can speak to you later. There's one gentleman over here, but I've just been cut off, so this is an easy question, I hope.
Have you started a department of cosmology, and how are you defining cosmology?
Oh, well, so the news to everybody in this room, especially our next speaker, is that we have started a department of cosmology, and Paul Steinhardt is leading. No, that's actually not true. the short answer is yes. We have two cosmologists on staff now. So there are two parts of your question, so I'll take them both in turn. We have a postdoctoral hire in cosmology, and we have a junior faculty hire in cosmology. The junior faculty hire, the postdoc is Stefan Hoffman, and the junior faculty is Justin Curry. And Justin is currently at MIT and will be coming here in January. We are having a cosmology workshop, in fact, that's happening next week, just to ensure that we don't have any lull in the use of Perimeter Institute over the next little while. How are we defining cosmology? That's a very interesting question. Cosmology, of course, is an extremely broad field, and again, I defer to Professor Steinhardt, who is a world-renowned expert in the field, but since you asked me and I'm on stage, one of the interesting aspects of the current state of affairs is that the boundaries between a lot of these fields are actually, to some extent, dissolving. So you have particle physics, you have cosmologists, you have string theorists, and you have some others who naturally overlap in terms of their research predilection and their interests. Now, there is a whole industry of cosmology that is directly evaluating all of the data that I alluded to before and doing a lot of the modeling and the very, very careful analysis of the data. That is not, by and large, what we expect to be going into by nature of our natural orientation, as you can probably surmise, which is not to say that it's impossible and that it won't happen, because occasionally you get very broad-thinking individuals who have interests in different areas, and so it's possible, but it's not likely. The natural likely resonance for us would be to be looking at early universe scenarios, to be looking at how you explain things like dark matter and dark energy and so forth from a foundational physics perspective, and bringing the wealth of our resources to bear on those sorts of problems. And we are motivated to do just that. And with that, I will thank all of you very much for coming, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you very much.